Welcome to the Math Ed Podcast. My name is Sam Otten from the University of Missouri, and today I'm joined by two co-authors of a new paper in the American Educational Research Journal. First is Kenneth Frank, who's from Michigan State University. Ken, thanks for being here.
Good to be here.
And second is Jihyun Kim, who's at Lehigh University. Jihyun, thanks so much for navigating the time difference and being here with us as well.
Thank you.
We're going to be talking about their article called From Interpretation to Instructional Practice, a Network Study of Early Career Teachers' Sense-Making in the Era of Accountability Pressures and Common Core State Standards. So it'll be a good look at early career teachers in mathematics and then how they're navigating some of the pressures that are on them. It's going to be a really interesting study and kind of a unique one. I haven't really read one like that before. But before we get into that study, I always like to first get a little bit of background. So Ken, starting with you, where was it that you did your dissertation, research, your graduate studies?
At the University of Chicago, I got my PhD. My advisor was Anthony Breich, who's well known for his work in multi-level models, and he's the president of the Carnegie Center for Advancement in Teaching.
All right. And Jihyun, how about you for your graduate studies?
I went to Michigan State, and my advisor is here, Dr. Ken Frank, and my another co-advisor was Dr. Peter Youngs. He's at UVA.
All right. So a lot of Michigan State connections here. Full disclosure, I went to Michigan State as well back in 2008, 2012 kind of era. But it's good to be talking to you. So your article is in the American Educational Research Journal, and it's From Interpretation to Instructional Practice, the Network Study of Early Career Teacher Sense-Making in the Era of Accountability Pressures and Common Core Standards. So Ken, I want to start with you. And I wonder if you could just sort of set the stage for us about how this article, how this study came about.
So the work really started when Peter Youngs came to Michigan State. And I had been studying teacher networks for a while. And Peter came and introduced me to the importance of teacher networks for early career teachers. The thinking is that early career teachers have less experience in the classroom, less professional identities, and they don't have as much resources to draw in terms of their people in their organization. So their networks can really matter a lot. And he and I did an early study about 10 years ago, sponsored by the Carnegie Foundation. And sure enough, we found some network effects on early career teachers. And then about 7-8 years ago, Peter said, you know, a weakness of that earlier study is we did not observe teachers in their classrooms. We only had survey data. And we didn't really link it to math or science instruction very directly, and that's an important area. So Peter and I decided to write some NSF grants because to observe teachers in classrooms is very expensive. You need to support a lot of graduate students to do that. So we wrote an NSF grant. We got pretty good scores, but not funded. Tried again, got worse scores. Tried again, got a little better scores, but not funded. And after getting rejected 3 or 4 times over maybe 3 years, Peter looked at me and said, well, do you still want to try? And I said, yeah, I don't have any better ideas, do you? And he said, nope. So we brought in at that point, Kristen Bieta, who's one of the co-authors on the paper. And Kristen really added in an element about focusing on planning for instruction. That was important because I understand it's a very important area in math ed. But also planning can be social. It can be a function of the network, especially for the early career teacher, because if you don't have a lot of experience, it's pretty tough to plan because you can't anticipate what's going to happen in the classroom. And Kristen, I think, intuitively really connected with the social network aspect of our thinking. Well, we tuned and tweaked, and we decided to put in for funding with NSF and also WT grants as kind of our last hurrah. And what happened was we got funded by WT Grant, which was very exciting. So, and then a month or two later, we got questions from NSF. And we said, we called up NSF. We said, you should know we got funded by WT Grant. And they said, that's okay. Don't change the budget. And we're like, okay. And we let WT Grant know we were getting questions from NSF. And WT Grant said, that's okay. And there were different parts that each organization was interested in. NSF in particular wanted a strong qualitative aspect to our work to inform the network processes and models. And WT Grant was perhaps more interested in the Common Core policy context, which kind of makes sense if you know they're two organizations. So there were separate pieces. And in the end, we got both funding. So that's great. And I want to add also, Serena Salum our co-author, joined at about that point and added in a great element of the policy and leadership. Especially, she was familiar with Indiana, but she had come out of U of M, University of Michigan, and so added a lot from the broad policy perspective all the way down to the teacher. So great, we're cooking. And we get all of our graduate students lined up, which is going to be a big project to go into the field and observe hopefully 150 some teachers on multiple occasions over a couple of years. So it's a big deal. And about a few months into the project, we've learned the IQA evaluation scale, or observation scale, I should say. And the students are learning that, and then they start to apply it in the field, and it's not working for us. And this is going to be our dependent variable, our main outcome, how we're going to characterize teachers' teaching. And it's not working because it's a good observation rubric, but it's really tailored to a particular form of training and professional development. And some of the districts that we were studying didn't have that professional development. They had a very different orientation. So the observation rubric wasn't really picking up variation in their teaching. So this is a huge thing. We've got a big project, multiple funders, there's a big ship moving, and our dependent variable doesn't look promising. So Kristen and a graduate student at the time, Adrian Hu, Kristen Bieda and Adrian Hu, did some very heavy lifting. And they looked around for other rubrics for observation. They did a lot of research, and they found something called TrueMath, which had been developed by Alan Schoenfeld and my current dean, Bob Floden. And that looked like it was going to work for us because the TrueMath rubric really picked up on the nuances of interaction between teachers and students. The TrueMath rubric includes, well, four dimensions that we use: the mathematics, the cognitive demand, the agency and authority of and identity. That's sort of what the students contribute to the process, and uses of assessment. So you got math, cognitive demand, the students in there. It's a great rubric for capturing the interaction between the students and the teacher, not just what the teacher is doing. But it was really in beta mode when we picked it up. So Kristen and Adrian was familiar with TrueMath from another project. Kristen and Adrian, along with a couple of very senior math ed grad students, learned it and trained everybody on it, on the project, so that everybody could go into the field. And along the way, we're wrestling with issues like video versus face-to-face. Should episodes be substantively defined or every 10 minutes? We chose every 10 minutes. So every 10 minutes, a teacher gets a score on each of the four dimensions we would ultimately use. And it's working. It's working better. But it takes a lot of effort to get everybody on board with high reliability. And we learned along the way to sustain that reliability. It turned out that, you know, each rater could drift on any given quarter, any given 3 or 6 month interval, and required some retraining. Okay, good. So now this outcome, TrueMath, seems to be working better for us. And we kind of already knew how to get social network data from teachers. We asked them in the fall and then again the spring who their closest colleagues are, who helps them with instruction. And then in the winter, we try and survey the people named in the fall. And then we use that data ultimately to model spring behaviors. So we had that design from our earlier study, our Carnegie study. So we were good with that. We had a lot of survey data that a lot of people contributed a great amount to. And so now, you know, I'm going to fast forward a little bit. There were bumps and bruises along the way, but I would say the normal bumps and bruises of data collection, with Serena Salim in particular and Peter really hustling a lot to make sure the data collection goes well. All along, also coordinated by Nicole Ellison, our project coordinator, who herded a lot of cats. So now what's happening is we've got all of these graduate students in the field collecting data. And a lot of them were former teachers, Teach for America, had been in public school classrooms. Ji Hunt was had been a teacher. They had most of them training in ed policy. Most, if not all of them, trained in social network analysis. And so they are the eyes and ears in the field, and they're coming back and bringing great things to the project. So Sarah Gailey sees the importance of instructional coaches and writes about that in her dissertation. Adrian Hu and Caitlin Torfey see the importance of social media, Pinterest in particular, and have a whole huge project on that with special issues of Teachers College Record, American Journal of Education on that. John Lane brings a leadership perspective and published an AERJ on that. And Chi Hun saw sort of the whole thing from the ed policy through to the right up close to the teacher's experience and had the network perspective. And I'll say a little bit more about Chi Hun. About just before she got in the project, she had taken my networks course, and I invite guest speakers to that course. And one was Jim Spillane. And Jim's very well known for distributed leadership. He does math ed stuff. I'm sure he's a very prominent guy. And he's presenting, and Ji-Hun Kim, a first-year student, kind of went toe-to-toe with Jim Spillane for about 10 minutes on distributed leadership and networks and really caught his attention and mine as well. So she was well-prepared when she got in the field to be thinking about the network side and how that might affect teachers' behaviors. Okay, so good. So now, fast forward to roughly 2018, we've been collecting data for 3 years. We've got our 150 teachers. We've navigated in and out with the Common Core that Indiana did. And now we have the possibility to look at how teachers' perceptions of the Common Core, their perceptions of evaluation, their network members in their school, all affect their instructional practices as measured by TrueMath, controlling for their instructional practices in the fall. So we're going to, our outcome measure is going to be spring TrueMath as observed 2 consecutive days with fall TrueMath as a control. Informing these models is the survey data, of course, but we've also been conducting a lot of the interviews that NSF really pushed us on. So we've been listening to teachers, hearing how they make sense of their teaching and these forces. Kim Jansen and Nicole Elliston did a lot of study of the planning process and teachers' articulation of that planning process in interviews. They're helping us understand the planning.
So, Ken, I appreciate you sharing that, and especially I resonate with the perseverance back at the start to get the funding. That's the same kind of experience that we have, taking multiple tries and finding the right fit stuff and finding the right team. So I resonate with that. It's great to hear all the work that's coming forward. I wonder, Ji-Hun, if you could tell us a little bit about the publications that have come out of that study thus far, and especially this AERJ paper that we're interested in.
Yeah, before I move on to the next topic, I just want to mention that what Dr. Frank said about the choice of observation rubric, that whole process is well documented in a recent paper authored by Dr. Vieira and other co-authors published in Journal of Classroom Interaction. And I can talk about the main findings of ARJ paper. The first main finding was that early career teachers, their own perceptions of accountability policies did not have any effect on their instructional practices, but their social network members' perceptions of those accountability pressure had effects on early career teachers' instructional practices measured by TrueMath. So that was pretty surprising to me, because we thought about sense-making theory, and usually when we think about policy implementation and the effects of policies, teachers' own perception in general is very, very important factor for teachers' behaviors and their instructional practices. But in this case, very interestingly, their social network members' perceptions of external policy pressure was very, very strong factor for their instructional practices.
So are you saying that it especially mattered how the social network of the early career teacher interpreted the pressures? That mattered maybe more than just what the sort of external pressures were independent of the social network. Is that a good interpretation?
So yes. There are two different things here. So one is the interpretation of the policy versus actual policy. The second distinction is their own interpretation of the policy versus their social network members' interpretation of the policies. So I think in our paper, we talked a lot about individual teachers' interpretation versus actual policy, and we focus more on this, their own interpretation of the policy. And interestingly, what we found was their social network members' interpretation of that policy was important in shaping early career teachers' instructional practices.
I'll add when people came back from the field, there was a strong emphasis on the district context. Some of the districts we were studying, for example, had nearly scripted curricula. Others, it was almost freeform, to individualized teachers developing their own curricula. The districts were in different states, which had different adherence to Common Core and different accountability, et cetera. So we did control for districts in our study. We basically accounted for which district any given teacher was in, and anything that came with that district that would have elevated the true math scores or the network members' perceptions was accounted for. So if District A has particularly high true math scores or particularly high network members' perceptions, then that's adjusted. So the analyses are essentially comparing teachers with other teachers within their own district. That's how they should be interpreted. This is called a fixed effects analysis. So in that sense, we're screening off, not screening off, but the districts capture a lot of that external force effect. And then the emphasis here is on how the network members filter the district context onto the early career teacher.
Great. And are there some other findings that you also want to mention while we're here?
So one of the striking things for us was we did our analyses. Remember, there are four dimensions of true math that we had picked up on: math content, cognitive demand, the student agency, and the use of assessment. And we looked, each time we were looking at factors that we predict, we wanted to know if they predicted stronger or weaker for some dimensions rather than others. But in most cases, and it's true in the final paper, that the factors that predicted, they predicted more or less evenly, the network did, more or less evenly across the dimensions. Sometimes the statistical significance was stronger in one dimension than another, but if you kind of did a test to see if they were different, really different effects across dimensions, they were not. So that's kind of interesting. And that goes with a lot of findings we have about network effects, that when we look at the effects of your network on your behavior for a professional, a teacher, they are not always huge. They're not, you know, there are other things that can have profound effects on a teacher, professional development or what have you. But the network effects seem to be there on many different behaviors, types of instructional practices, from technology to adopting a school-based reform to their true math score. So the network effects tend to be there. And this finding that they're there across all the dimensions is kind of consistent with that. So worth note, it does, because the network effects tend to be small, that's why we need 150 teachers or so, 100 to 150, in order to pick them up. Because if we come in with a study of 40 teachers, it's very difficult to have the power to detect them.
So having done the study in ARJ, I'm just curious if you've kind of come to some personal realizations yourself having done the study, or if there are some things that are still questions, you know, still on your mind even after the study.
Yeah, so I learned a couple of things in the course of working on this study in the paper, which is usually the case. And really this was at the hands of the ARJ reviewers and my colleagues. So the first is, I could not imagine how any teacher, especially an early career teacher, could navigate evaluation pressures, especially which were getting a strong push from value added. These were teachers teaching in 2016-17. So evaluation pressures, as well as standards, Common Core standards. It seemed to me that the two were just pushing in opposite directions, and it was a magical feat if you could navigate them both. But as Kristen Bieta, I think, had been trying to teach me all along, and as the reviewers finally taught me, if you really think hard about what ambitious mathematics instruction means, there's a sense that it's authentic context, and is cognitively demanding, can go deep and give meaning. And if you can teach that way, then you can, through the authenticity, through both those things, kids can do just fine on this. They can do well on standardized tests that are associated with evaluation. And also you can be covering the Common Core standards. In the first drafts of the paper, I think, I'm sure, my writing did not appreciate the way ambitious instruction could help a teacher navigate those two forces. So that was one thing that we learned. The other thing is that this paper is about sense making. Sense making is in the title. The title is From Interpretation to Practice. And I think Gian and I were both quite familiar with Carl Weick's work, Cynthia Coburn, Jim Spillane on sense making generally and in education. But when we really got down to apply it, we just didn't quite get it right at first. And one reviewer just kept saying, you don't have it right. We said our outcome was a sense making, I'm sorry, our predictor, our perception of evaluation and accountability pressures in the Common Core. We thought those perceptions were sense making. And that's not right, the way the sense making literature is expressed. And what we have in the final paper is it's the link between the interpretation of the pressures and the practice. The link is the sense making. That's where the teacher, they're turning it into action, and part of sense making is turning an interpretation into action. So I think I now have a more nuanced understanding of the sense making, and that's not just abstract. It's very important because it's all about the teacher's instructional practice. It drives you to the instructional practice, which is ultimately what has the effect on learning for the kids. So that's how the paper's written now, but there was a lot of learning and sense making on our own going on to understand that concept.
And Jihyun, is there things that are still on your mind even after publishing the article?
Yeah, so I'm interested in how colleagues really communicate their interpretation about policy to early career teachers. So we had some interview data in this paper, and then we tried to kind of explain a little bit about that. But our interview was about their planning and collective planning and how social networks shape their planning. So I think we could study further about the interaction between experienced colleagues, mentors and colleagues, and early career teachers, like how they communicate their expectation or social norms about policy implementation and how they interpret the pressure from outside of the school. So in our paper, I think it's really important to highlight this finding quantitatively. That's what we did. But qualitatively, I want to study further about this process of collective sense making and the communication between early career teachers and experienced teachers, and how their different identities, characteristics shape this interaction and their reaction to the teacher evaluation policy and other accountability policies.
My guests are Ken Frank from Michigan State University and Jihyun Kim from Lehigh University. And thank you so much for speaking about that work. It is, like I said, it's kind of a unique study, at least for me, to read about the different dimensions that you took on, and a important one about early career teachers who are so vital. You know, we need more of them. We need them to be successful and support them. So this is great to understand a little bit more about their experience.
I just want to emphasize how the paper reflects the initial story that I told. So the paper has these elements of the external forces, the accountability pressures, the evaluation, and it has as an outcome an observation scale, developed by math from a math ed perspective, and it has a network element. And so it's got all the elements of all the people that gathered along the way. And the whole paper isn't possible unless, you know, all those people are contributing. So for me, that was very exciting, something I think no one of us could have done by themselves. And there it is in a mainstream education journal. But I'm hoping it speaks very strongly to the math ed community and makes some connections there that are really important to understand early career and math ed teaching.
Mm-hmm. Before we go, I have one final question I want to ask each of you. And this is just a little bit of a fun question. Try to have a little bit of fun when we can in this world. But I want to ask what you might imagine doing if you weren't in education research. And I'm actually going to start with Jihyun on this question, if you want to go first.
Yeah, I thought about this question. I probably would have been a writer who wrote novels like Harry Potter or...
Yes.
that's my dream.
You can still have a little notebook, or you can still have a draft going on the side. And Ken, can you imagine yourself doing something else?
Yeah, first I'll pick up Jihyun's contributions to this were huge throughout and all the way through to the end on the writing. We were co-writing and we're co-first authors on this. And, you know, I'd write a sentence and she was totally, that's not how you want to frame that sentence, which was really striking. We were in each other's minds. So that writing aspect came out, Jihyun, and I didn't know that. So Well, if I weren't an education researcher, I might be a sociologist, but that's cheating. So I would be a letter carrier. I would be the guy in a small town delivering the mail all over because, one, I like to walk in pretty much all kinds of weather. And two, it's a social network. Oh, look who got invited to the wedding. Oh, yeah, you know. So that would be very interesting to me.
My family, we have a strong connection with our mail carrier because we're from a small town on a rural route. We were just Otten's rural route too, and the mail carrier knew to give it to us. But speaking of Harry Potter, my brothers and I, we sat out at the mailbox on the day that they were delivering Harry Potter 7. So we were waving, and the mail carrier pulled up and said, "I know what you're waiting for," and like pulled out the book to give to us. So yeah, we have a good connection with both the novels and the mail carrying, but more important than ever. So, well, it's been great talking to both of you. Thanks so much for sharing your work.
Thanks for having us, Sam, and thanks for doing this podcast. I think it's a great idea.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. And speaking of becoming a writer in an alternative life, I want to use this closing to share that I've written a children's book. And even though it's not a math book, I still think it's something that listeners of this podcast will enjoy. And it's inspired by math ed in two ways. The book is called Missing Letters, an Alphabet Book. And it's a different sort of alphabet book. Instead of going through the alphabet and having words that start with each letter, Missing Letters shows what can happen if each letter is removed. So it's basically a word game where you start with a word, remove a letter, and then see what happens. The letters are emphasized through their absence. And young preschoolers can really hear the difference, while elementary kids can compare the changes in spelling. The illustrations by Leon Thomas emphasize the humor or the drama or sometimes the absurdity of the transformed words. And this missing letter word game encourages kids to play with language. Even beyond the book, you can come up with your own word pairs. So what are the two inspirations from math education? The first is the premise itself of understanding a letter by looking at what happens when it's missing. In math education, we know that kids shouldn't just see examples of a concept, they should also see non-examples to truly understand it. Plus, it's fun to use creativity to come up with non-examples. The second thing is that the entire book is structured as a proof. People outside of math wouldn't notice it, but the opening line is an overarching claim. Each letter is important. And then the book proceeds case by case, showing that each letter is important because things change if they're removed. A is important because without A, acorn becomes corn. B is important because without B, block becomes lock. This structure not only draws kids into a rhythm, but also helps them get comfortable using because and then providing evidence. By the end, the overall claim has been proven. So anyway, I'm really excited for the book. I recommend it for kids aged 2 to 7 or for teachers pre-K to first grade. Again, it's called Missing Letters, an Alphabet Book. You can see excerpts and find out how to order it at missinglettersbook.com. That's missinglettersbook.com.